Upshot, Multi-World Disc Golf's podcast about the latest in the disc golf world. I'm the publisher, Charlie Eisenhood, and joining me is Jamie Thomas. Jamie, hello. How you doing?
Hey there. You know what? It is summer, and I feel like we've been saying this for a while now. Things are opening up. The barbecues are starting. We're a couple weeks away from disc golf. We actually may have a pretty fun summer on our hands, despite everything that's been going on this year. So I will say that I am more optimistic by the day, especially now that there's, what, 8 days till the Pro Tour restarts?
That's great. I mean, yeah, we're getting very close to the resumption of the tour. I don't know if I would quite call myself optimistic at this point. I mean, there's just a little bit too much negative data from some states about cases and hospitalizations going up, that I'm worried about what it means down the line. But certainly in terms of disc golf, I feel like, hey, you know, you can go out and play. The tour is going to come back. We just saw the restart of the PGA Tour, and that sure went did. Well. It went really well, aside from an F-bomb that got dropped on the middle of the broadcast and, you know, Jim Nantz having to apologize. But I love that. So, you know, it's like, it's not, everything's a little weird, but, you know, I mean, think about, like, it's almost a dream scenario for the Disc Golf Pro Tour. There's no sports right now. People are stuck at home, and they're about to come back, and they're going to have Disc Golf Network paywall live coverage. I mean, this is like a perfect storm for subscriber signups. Is it not?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the way you draw it up. It's not the way you hope it happens, obviously.
Of course.
But it's, you know, when you talk about silver linings, I think, like, just really quickly, you have to kind of tip the cap to the Pro Tour team behind the scenes for turning around and losing two events, but then getting those events back on the, or getting events on the schedule with the Dynamic Disc Open and the Preserve Championship, because suddenly you're staring at it. There's still a full season that's going to happen on the Pro Tour this year, and being the only live coverage, because, well, at least until USDGC, all the other live opportunities for this season have been canceled. So, man, it really puts them in the driver's seat of their own destiny, which, being able to say that confidently now compared to 12, 14, 18 months ago, that this is, I don't want to beat the dead horse, but it's a 180 degree turnaround, and it's looking up in a very positive way, I think.
Yeah, we're going to come back to this topic in more detail in a little bit. I want to circle back quickly to something we talked about on last week's show. And if you remember, I made an aside about, you know, I wonder how many times it takes people to win Worlds the first time. Because most people don't just show up and win it after never having played it. You know, you play it a few times when you're younger, and eventually, you know, you get good enough and you have your shot and you win. Well, shout out to Todd Lyon from the PDGA, who dropped the data on our Facebook post about of that episode and laid out all of the numbers. And it is actually quite interesting. So if you want to find this, you can dig it back up on our Facebook page. I think I'll also link it on the Multi-World Disc Golf article that houses this podcast if you want to find it and look at it for yourself. But the numbers are quite interesting. So since Ken Climo, who played once in 89 and then won it in 90 and went on to, you know, win all of those championships in a row through 98, an incredible run that will probably never be repeated again in the history of the sport. The average number of times that an MPO player played Worlds before winning their first title was 6.1 attempts. Now, you could call it years. I guess it's possible there was a player in there that didn't play for 1 year and but then played the next. So it was like six tries in 7 years or something. But pretty much it took 6 years in order to go from first playing a World Championships event to winning a World Championships event. Now, there were some big outliers in that mix. You know, Cam Todd only had to play two before winning. Greg Barsby played 13 before winning his in 2018. But it goes to show you that it's not like 20-year-old kids who are coming out of, you know, the next big thing show up at Worlds and win it. That's generally not what happens.
Right. And with the exception of, you know, the first handful of years, because there weren't that many World Championships.
Yeah, I'm beforehand. Sort of excluding those early 80s years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no disrespect to Sam Farrens in 84, who won it, just walked onto the scene and won it. Harold Duvall also obviously won the first year. I just did the numbers, Charlie. If you take into account all the outliers, the average is 4.2 repeating.
And that includes the 80s.
Yeah, that includes the 80s. It also includes Greg Barsby, whose 13 attempts before winning his, like you said, are the biggest. So, you know, even if that's still a reduction by a third, but it still proves the point that when you take the data that you should exclude, you know, nobody's coming up and all of a sudden taking this thing, especially not anymore.
Yeah.
But it kind of led us to think about a few of the players that we didn't really talk about in the best player to never win Worlds conversation last week, but a couple players that I would bet are on a lot of people's podiums were we to be talking about Salt, or were we to be in Salt Lake City or Ogden this week for Worlds itself, and we're talking about Simon and Eagle.
We would literally be at Worlds right now, wouldn't we?
Yep.
Man.
We'd be up there. But yeah, I mean, people would be talking about Simon. People would be talking about Eagle. And so we kind of looked up what they'd been doing. And because I know, obviously, Charlie, you think Eagle is due for one at some point in the near future.
Well, you got to think so, right?
Yeah.
He's the best player. He's the highest rated player at his age level. So, I mean, he's the only players rated higher than him right now are Paul McBeth and Ricky, right? I haven't looked at the ratings list in a little bit, so I don't know that for sure. But you would think that, you know, I think a lot of people will say, well, I can't believe Eagle hasn't already won one. But what's the number? How many has he played in?
Well, Eagle has played since 2015. That was his first Worlds. He started playing Open, I believe, in 2011. Didn't really go on tour. So he's got five under his belt. This would have been his sixth.
So there you go.
He's right in line.
Right in line.
Right in line.
And you look at some of the best players of all time. Paul McBeth, he played four events. He played four Worlds before he won it. Other multi-time world champions also played multiple years before they won it. Nate Doss played five. And then Ricky played five as well. So, you know, if you want to believe the numbers from some of those folks, I mean, maybe this would have been Eagle's year.
Could have been. Could have been the other Crush Boys year as well. Simon Lazat, his first Worlds was in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So he would have been going on to his seventh attempt at winning it. And we looked up Simon and Eagle because those two players are definitely going to be on people's podium picks. But I also looked up a third one, Charlie, because we can't get too wrapped up in all the new names and not talk about the old new name, the Kevin Jones, the KJ USA hype train here. How many Worlds do you think Kevin Jones has played in?
Well, it's not very many because he only has been on tour for a couple of years. I think he's probably only played in, I'm going to guess, three.
This would have been his third.
So he's only played in two.
Really close. He's played in two.
Wow.
So is he the guy that can break that number down, bring the average down a bit, or does he need a few more years? Because
I think he still needs a couple more years, but it's hard not to see the just incredible potential in his game. You know, you talk, we talk about this all the time. You know, who are the players who are coming up that feel like they're going to be at that next level? And I think it's fair to say that Simon and Eagle have already established themselves at that level. But you know, Kevin Jones has yet to really. I mean, he's been in USDGC final rounds as a contender, so it's not like he hasn't had a shot. But you know, you got to win a major really to get into that conversation. But clearly, he's somebody who could get there and be the next name to win their first world title. Calvin Heimberg for me also right there. I mean, both of those guys have showed already this season, let alone what they've done in the past, but this season, that they have special tools and have a chance to go out and win worlds, well, now in 2021.
Yeah, and look, I'm looking up Calvin Heimberg really quickly. It looks like he started playing, it looks like his first worlds was 2015, so he's kind of right in that same category that we're talking about. And as far as Kevin Jones goes, notable that he's on a four tournament hot streak, not four tournament wins in a row. Now, granted, not tour events, but he did just take down the Majestic. So in that world where we could just transpose performances over space and time, he's peaking at the right time for when Worlds would have been.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'd say pump the brakes a little bit. I mean, he's playing against very thin fields for the most part. Not that he's not playing well, but I don't know that I want to extrapolate him out to, you know, well, he won four in a row and now it would have been Worlds. Well, you know, most players haven't played. So a bit of a stretch. But let me ask you this, Jamie. Who is the next player to win their first Worlds? So I don't care who wins in 2021 or 2022. Like if it's Paul again a couple times, whatever. Who is the next player to win their first world title?
Oh my goodness. Well, first of all, the Kevin Jones hype train has now changed conductors if I'm the one making that statement on this podcast. I'll take over for a bit, Charlie. You go rest. I got you, KJ USA.
Listen, I'm not knocking Kevin Jones. I think he's a great player, but I don't want to say that he would have been the world champion this year because he won the Majestic.
Get out of here with your level-headedness. I'm trying to start the hot take engine back up. We're almost back to golf. And I'm really just stalling because that's a really good question you asked, and I don't have an answer ready because it's, oh man.
What's your gut say? I mean, it's not an easy answer. Depends on the courses, depends on how people are playing at the time. But like, if I just say that to you, who do you think of?
I mean, I have to say that Eagle's still my first pick. The way he prepares for tournaments is just, it's that next level. But again, that's so eye test based, right? And again, like you're saying, without knowing the course or anything like that, or how the flow is happening during the season, I mean, just he's the right eye test. I like I said, I like the way he prepares for events, the way he thinks about the game. But you know what? Honestly, low key, Nate Sexton just like refuses to go away. And not saying that in a bad way, but like he's in his 30s, you know. It would be very easy, were this the PGA and we had more and more years and more generations of touring pros, you look at a profile like Nate Sexton's and you go, yeah, USDGC, that's his top line. That's like what his high point in his career is going to be, and he's going to kind of, you know, grab a little win here and there, but he's just kind of slowly, he's just got a really nice long tail out.
What about James 40s. Conrad? Third Conrad place at 2019 Worlds.
Conrad would kind of be the other person that I would put. Like, if you're giving me a trio, if I could pick three that I think could like pop there first, I think it would be Eagle. It could be Sexton to kind of counter that narrative, just pop up and grab one. Or it's James Conrad. And look, man, if he can win USDGC, quote unquote, lefty course, and throw like three sidearms all weekend, he's got the skill set. He's got three pro tour wins. He's not a nobody anymore.
I'm gonna throw a crazy dart at you. It's not crazy, but it's a name that gets overlooked unfairly. And I think this player could be the next first time world champion. All right. He just re-signed a 3-year deal with his sponsor. Perhaps I give it away. Chris Dickerson. I mean,
he wins a lot.
I know Chris Dickerson is not he's not a big social media guy. He's not at every tour event. You know, you don't see him on the coverage all the time because he mostly plays close to home. But, you know, he's been in the mix at these tournaments. And, I mean, you can't ignore how good he's been playing really the last 2 or 3 years. He was solidly within the top 10 at Worlds last year. I'm going to look up his actual place. He was fifth. So people just kind of just don't. I feel like people don't think of Chris Dickerson when they think of like who are the top players, but like he definitely is one of the top players. And why not Chris Dickerson? I mean, he's shown that he can win the big tournaments. He doesn't have a major win yet, right?
No. He has. His big thing right now is being so far the only back-to-back disc golf pro tour champion. He wins a lot. That's the thing. I remember we did an article on him. Gosh, was it already last season? About his win rate. And again, like you're saying, he's doing what Paul Ulibarri used to do. A lot of ABC tiers.
Yeah, Chris Dickerson is rated higher than Simon Lazat.
That's when you make putts.
That's a fact. He is the fourth highest rated player in the world, behind Paul, Ricky, Eagle, and he is tied with Kevin Jones and Calvin Heimberg. But wow. Like we never talk about him in that way. It's funny. But I think right now, Eagle is definitely the right choice for this conversation. But I could see Dickerson doing it first. I really could.
Hey,
Dickerson's like just if he's got his very top level game, he's not gonna be rattled by the moment. I don't sense that from him at all. He just goes out there and plays his game, and when he's playing his best game, he can beat anybody.
See, I like where you're going with this. His first Worlds was 2016, so he's getting right to that point where the data says the average is. And it's a great point you make about the moment not being too big. One of the things, and this is pulling on my experience as an LSU fan watching college football, you know, we had Nick Saban as our coach. Now Nick Saban's over at Alabama. One of the most frustrating things about losing to Alabama as many times as we had as a fan base in the last decade was that the way it looked when the Crimson Tide were just like squeezing the life out of you, just like so routine, so regular, every single play that you just like slowly felt the hope go away as the seconds ticked down. And that's the Chris Dickerson putt. Like his putt is so routine, so regular, so repeatable. I feel like he hits the same chain link. If he putts 10 putts from the same distance, he hits the same chain link with the same amount of force every time. And when you're on a card with that, and I don't care what anybody says, the pros are very good at, they have a great mental game. They have their strengths. They have, you know, the things they do. But eventually, the fact that the guy just will not miss a putt, it will start to play in your mind 100%. As the holes start to run out, because you have to force, you got to force his hand at some point. So if Chris Dickerson gets in that position in Worlds, I would expect him to finish out strong and take down the win.
Quick correction. I apologize. I was looking at the 2019 Worlds results, which has the ratings from the time. He is still, in fact, the fourth highest rated player in the world, but he has that solo. He's 1042 rated right now. So he's 1 point ahead of Calvin Heimberg at 1041. Macbeth up in the rarefied air of 1061. What is that? 13 points clear of Eagle at 1048, who's in second.
Wow.
Yeah.
People getting good. And
don't forget, Jackie Chen, 1040 rated.
Let's go, Jackie Chan.
There are seven players who are 1040 rated or better. Six of them are Macbeth, McMahon, Wysocki, Dickerson, Heimberg, Lazat. And then there's Jackie Chan.
Okay. You know what?
That's incredible.
We have to meditate on this for a second, because first of all, Jackie Chan, of all the things that have happened in 2020, how did I kind of temporarily forget
about the shock to the world? That was in 2020, wasn't it?
Yes. That was like right after Samui Swine.
This year is insane.
This is ridiculous. But he's still there. He's still like another silver lining. Jackie Chan, still 1040 plus rated. I have no idea how many tournaments he's been able to play or if there have even been any tournaments.
Well, he has only the one rating.
Okay, so great. He has not had to go out and defend that rating yet. He's just cruising through 2020 really high up there. That's awesome.
That's so awesome. Oh, I cannot believe that was in 2020. I feel like I don't even remember what happened earlier this year in disc golf. I mean, I do, but it's just, what a bizarre 3 or 4 months we've had. And now we're going to go back on tour. Like, the hard part hasn't even started yet for the Disc Golf Pro Tour. I mean, okay, they like laid out all the ideas. They have the tournament schedule, but like, you have to actually go out and execute the events now with social distancing and these travel pods where players are not allowed to, like, you know, have interactions with people from outside of their travel group. And it feels like I'm very hopeful that everything just works perfectly, but it does seem like it's going to be challenging.
Yeah, I can't imagine a world where the rules are followed perfectly. And I'm not saying the Pro Tour is going to go out and not follow the rules. Obviously, they've set the plan. They're working with local authorities. You know, they're getting everything approved. So they're not going to go out and say, oh, we don't care. But, I mean, how long is it going to be before it's just normal human nature? Especially, you've got people that are used to seeing each other week in and week out. Like, you know, I hope it all works out, but I would just say, like, as disc golf fans, we should probably, you know, don't jump on anybody's case if you don't see everything being perfectly followed. It's not that people are necessarily trying to set a bad example. How are you going to do all of this and enforce all of this over a tour? I don't want that job. I can tell you that much.
Yeah.
That's not the job I want right now. I'm perfectly happy to sit in the booth and just call the golf.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to, well, we'll see what happens. I'm looking forward to talking to players about it once they get back out on the road. What's it like?
Yeah.
Does this make it harder to play? What is it like to have no fans there? I agree, like, there needs to be a reasonable expectation that people are going to accidentally, you know, get within 6 feet of each other sometimes. And it's easy to fall into the habits of tour, especially when you're talking about, like, this is a professional endeavor. You know, this is the job of these players. So they're going to be focusing on playing disc golf, and they're not going to be necessarily thinking about, like, is my mask on right? Am I correctly distanced away from the camera operator and all of those kinds of things? Mm-hmm. But that said, you know, there needs to be also some recognition that there has to be, like, disc golf pro tour people need to be on top of it, because, you know, not only from like an optics perspective, but from a safety perspective, you know, you don't want to have a COVID outbreak on tour. That is a nightmare.
Right.
And
it's a nightmare because of the PR. I mean, it's a nightmare because of COVID. Like, that probably came out wrong. You don't want people to get sick, first and foremost, obviously. It's a nightmare because, like, it's a PR nightmare because that same it's a double-edged sword, is what I'm trying to say. We have the spotlight. There's not a lot of other sports on. Also, the spotlight is on us. So, depends on how you want to phrase that. There's two possible ways to look at that. But I just hope that, like, fans don't freak out. If you see, you know, like, oh, if it's not being perfectly adhered to, like, don't go call people out on social media. Don't, like, just don't do that stuff.
I agree
with you. Appeal to the better angels of our nature. Because at least the one thing I will say right now, the World Health Organization has come out and said that asymptomatic transmission is rare. So if we're following the guidelines and nobody shows up with a fever, nobody shows up with symptoms, nobody shows up testing positive, it's very rare for them to transmit it to one another. And I think is it the CDC or the WHO said that surface touching transmission is also very, very low. So disc golf, we're in a pretty good spot. Let's like everybody be cool. Everybody follow the rules. Nobody freak out. We're going to have a cool season. We have a weird season, but it's going to be a good one.
Yep. Hoping for the best. Done. And again, you know, mentioned at the top of the show, PGA Tour came back. And they are doing more than the Pro Tour. You know, they're testing players before events, upon arrival to the city for the tournament. If players want to take the shuttle flight that they chartered, you have to get tested again. But at the same time, like, I think it's reasonable not to expect the Pro Tour to go to those lengths. And the Pro Tour has said that they are going to make testing available to players. And, you know, obviously, if there's any kinds of, like, if somebody's symptomatic or has too high of a temperature, obviously, at that point, they're going to get tested. So we'll see how this all plays out. And, you know, I think what you say is true, Jamie. I mean, it's obviously a sport where you're playing outside, you're using your own equipment. You know, that seems to me like if you're smart about doing hand sanitizing once in a while, you know, the odds of there being like coronavirus on the basket that gets onto the disc and that gets onto your hands and then it goes into your, you know, your eyes or your mouth. I mean, I guess it's possible, but it doesn't really seem likely, given what we know. So I think if the Pro Tour is smart and they have things under control, which they've clearly thought through this, there's no reason it can't be smooth, just as smooth as the PGA Tour's restart.
Definitely. And, you know, we quick reference to the articles that have come out on the site this week where we did the anonymous player interviews or survey rather, and people kind of gave us feedback on a variety of topics. Well, one of those topics was addressing essentially confidence in the disc golf pro tour's direction, and confidence from the touring pros who responded is very, very high. So it's great to have that buy-in as well.
Yeah, it was a very interesting study. We're going to talk more about the survey results, this anonymous survey from professional players, on a later show, because not everything's come out yet. But I found it particularly interesting to see that players seem to prefer disc golf pro tour events to NTs. And that's not what I would have expected, I will be honest. I was expecting to see the reverse, but maybe that this, you know, the last, even just this beginning of this year, there's been a bit of a shift on that front given the changes to the Pro Tour.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's actually what I expected. Kind of just given the anecdotal evidence. Yeah, just talking to pros, you know, when we do get out to the tournaments or when they kind of come through my backyard and we get to hang out, and I'll say Nate and Val mentioned this last week, that even at the very beginning of the Pro Tour, I think what Steve Dodge always had was the players trusted that he had their best interests at heart for the tour. And I think that preserving that through the leadership change has been the biggest win for the Disc Golf Pro Tour in the transition from last year to this year. So what I was surprised to see on along that same line was that the pros still by and large feel that the national tour and especially the majors, that surprises me less. I expect that. But the national tour, they feel, still plays a very important part in promoting the pro scene. So they, you know, they tend to favor the disc golf pro tour, but they still feel that the national tour is very important. And I kind of thought you would be in one camp or the other. So that was very interesting to me. The pros kind of just want opportunities to play, and they want to feel like they're taken care of if we're making like general blanket statements.
Yeah, and you know, I will change gears here. And so the first article that came out talked about players' views of the PDGA, and one of the things that they pointed out is that they think that the PDGA should be focusing more on professional disc golf. And I'm like, absolutely not. Like, no. Like, thank God professional disc golfers don't decide everything in the organization, because I think that that's completely short-sighted and focused on their needs rather than the needs of disc golf as a whole, as a sport. And not that I don't think professional disc golfers should be well represented, given the importance that they play in promoting the sport. And I've said that on the show, but the idea that the PDGA should be doing more for pros than for AMs, or like moving further in the direction of focusing on professional disc golf, to me is completely wrong. That's why the Disc Golf Pro Tour exists in my mind. Like, that is the organization that should be focusing on professional players. And the PDGA should be spending less time and energy on things like the National Tour, because it takes away from what they're able to do to develop the sport with all of the other constituencies. Like, it turns out that like having a really well-run amateur events and all of the other things that the PDGA does, trying to get disc golf into schools, all that work, trust me when I say that's more important for them to be working on than, you know, putting an extra $15,000 into the pot for a national tour event.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And look, I've said on the show many times that the PDGA needs to step up their national tour under the context of a competition with the pro tour for the better tour, as it were. But when you phrase it in the way you're saying it, Charlie, that I completely agree with you. Even though it may sound like I'm contradicting myself, it's like anybody who's run a tournament knows that 9 times out of 10, the people who come to your tournament trying to earn their paycheck, they're the toughest people. They're the toughest customers to please. So, you know, if you want to create the vibe of a tournament about growth, about introducing new people, having hardcore competitors who are trying to make their paycheck is not the vibe you want at that event. So if the message is growth, if the goal is growth and ambassadorship and stewardship of the game, you do have to focus on the amateur side of things. And it is important to point out that at this time, we can make those statements because right now the Pro Tour has the trust of the players, as we've now seen in the early results of the data. And they, you know, that backs up what they've been saying as well. But there's an avenue for a great professional experience and a great fan experience, which can frankly potentially free the PDGA up to even more hyper focus if that is something that they chose to do. Now, I guess the only other wrinkle in there is what we said. Still like the national tour, and the pros love the majors. So, you know, I think that probably we're in agreement here. You don't take the focus all the way off the pros.
No.
You need to highlight them in some way.
Yes.
Internally to the organization, even alongside the existence of the DGPT. But amateurs are going to grow the base. And as you grow the base, you're going to get more fans, you're going to get more competitors, you may get more people that are going to challenge the titles and the accolades of all the people we've been talking about much earlier in the show when it comes to worlds and majors and all that good stuff.
Yeah, we're going to have more conversations on this topic going in the subscriber bonus segment a little bit later. We're going to talk about the Pro Tour's path in the future. And, you know, what does it take? What does it look like for the Disc Golf Pro Tour to be successful in 5 or 10 years? And so we will discuss that more in our subscriber bonus segment. You can become a subscriber at discgolf.ultiworld.com/subscribe. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking fourth major and the future of the majors. Stay with us. It's The Upshot. The Upshot is presented by Pound Disc Golf, makers of the best bags in the sport. From 3D modeling to technical materials, Pound utilizes current technology to push product development beyond the current boundaries. They also build all the prototypes themselves and test them extensively. That's why they're happy to give a full guarantee of their products, lifetime guarantee. Check out the bags at PoundDiscGolf.com. Welcome back to The Upshot. So we mentioned this last week on the show. The PDGA is considering starting a fourth major as early as 2022. There's a long history here as they've been working towards this over the last couple of years. And now there's a formal proposal from the majors committee that's going to get reviewed by the board of directors, and things look like they are moving towards that. And when we published the story, I got a message on Facebook from Steve Brinster, the 20-year veteran, won 100 PDGA events. He won a USDGC. He's won an NT. Legend of the game. And he said, it's funny that you wrote about this because this looks a lot like what I laid out in a Facebook post a year ago. And so I went back on Steve Brinster's page on Facebook and I found this piece that he wrote. It's basically an opinion column on Facebook. So I'm going to read it here now, or at least read most of it. And then Jamie, I'd love to talk a little bit about it because, you know, it's funny. It's like, as important as majors are, we don't necessarily see a lot of writing about their importance. Players talk about it, but you know, you don't have this kind of like long history of people talking about it in print or even in videos necessarily. So this from Steve Brinster I thought was very interesting. Here's what he had to say. Dear fellow disc golfers, PDGA members, and the PDGA board of directors, what defines our sport? What defines any sport? It's history. When you think of professional golf, what do you think about? Is it Jack Nicklaus's 18 majors? Is it Tiger's 14? Or is it Augusta in the green jacket? Are you watching to see if Jordan Spieth can win another major? Is he the next great champion? When you think about tennis, what do you think about? Is it Roger Federer's 20 majors? Is it Nadal's and Djokovic's 14 and 13 and how they are both on pace to become the all-time major leaders? Let's not forget about Serena Williams and her 23 major singles titles. Alternatively, do you think about the prestige of Wimbledon or maybe the US Open? Majors should be the backbone of disc golf's history, and we need to establish a solid foundation upon which to build our sport. Currently, we have no foundation. We do not have a set number of majors. We do not have records that allow us to compare players of this generation to players of the past. Moreover, until we can establish a foundation, we won't have a way to compare the great players of today to players of the future. We have an opportunity right now to start writing our history out in a more meaningful way. It's time to establish the annual majors of disc golf. I propose we have four majors. I know, revolutionary, right? However, sometimes we have to take the lead from our big brother and go with what has proven to be successful. The big four. The World Championships rotates throughout the world. The US Open, or USDGC, and US Women's, US only. The European Open rotates throughout Europe. The PDGA Championship rotates throughout the world. I want to propose that the PDGA add $50,000 to each of the majors. Competition is the single most vital factor in hosting a major, and we need to make sure that as we write our history, that winning a major is as meaningful as possible. By adding significant financial support, we can ensure that the most crucial aspect of establishing a major championship gets preserved. An elite field of players is present. No more winning a major with only 5 to 10 real potential winners. No more changing names. No more backtracking with the number of majors. Let's work together to make winning a major in disc golf more meaningful. Four different titles with four distinct trophies. Additionally, by adding this kind of money to major events, we will allow our TDs to focus on the course, the competition, and other important aspects of running a quality event. I know firsthand, after running large events for years, that gathering added cash is the most exhausting and time-consuming piece of running a tournament. If we can remove the stress of financial requirements, we may begin to see events held on premier courses that couldn't previously host a big event due to financial constraints. While I understand that we are talking about a substantial amount of money, I think we owe it to the sport to preserve the most essential aspect of the game, its history. There has been an explosion of interest in disc golf at the professional level over the past few years, and I think we have a golden opportunity to usher in a new era of prestige and glory for our burgeoning sport. Thanks for reading, and I look forward to discussing further. And this was written on August 24th, 2018, so just under 2 years ago. Jamie, a lot to unpack there. What do you think about what Steve had to say?
A lot to unpack. I was just kind of like, when we got to the numbers part, that's where my brain really clicked on. Because I think for me, and I think it'll be no surprise to anybody that listens to this, everything he said up to the numbers part, are we in agreement with? Do we need to like go into the details of that? I feel like we've covered that.
No, we've covered it. I think we've established that we both feel four majors make sense, and we've talked about why.
Yeah, I think I guess if there was one thing, I might say the PDGA Championship probably needs to be a rotating U.S. event in the near term, and then eventually go into a rotating world event. Just because I don't know, like, is Europe going to draw two majors worth of people a year right now? That's still a question mark. Let's get Worlds over there first. Other than that, I'm totally with everything he's saying there. So I'm more interested in talking about, he's saying drop 200K from the PDGA coffers per year into these majors. And that is a bold ask, because I think it's what something along the lines of, and the PGA provides support, so don't take this as me saying this is the only thing they do. But in terms of strict financial compensation, I believe it's like $3,000 an NT. I hope I'm not drastically misquoting that, but that's my understanding, is it's like $3,000 contribution from the PDGA to help the local club that runs an NT. Let's say majors are more. Well, if that's true, let's say majors are $5,000, just to kind of make up some numbers for the point of this. So you're talking about $40,000 roughly, plus the PDGA brings their staff, their crew, you know, they process all the results. They still do a lot of other things. But in terms of strict financial considerations, they're spending roughly $40,000 donating to the local clubs to help them put on the event. Brinster wants a fivefold increase in that just for the majors. So that got me thinking, what does that mean? Well, quick stats. In the most recent year-end demographics we have the 2019 PDGA year-end demographic report. There were 53,366 active members in 2019. Roughly 10,700 of which were pro memberships at $75 a head. That's roughly 800,000 in gross receipts from your pro memberships. Amateurs, you're about 42,700, roughly 2.13 million amateur gross receipts from amateur memberships. Now, that's not all pure profit, mind you. I don't have access to the PDGA's books, but they obviously have operating costs, and they have initiatives and things that we empower our board of directors to spend money on. So I'm not saying, oh, look, they have $3 million. They automatically can do it. But I just want to put some context on some of the numbers. The last number I'll give you, Charlie, is the tour events. Now, tour events on this sheet means any PDGA-sanctioned event. It doesn't mean tour like we talk about on the show. There are 4,651 events. You pay per player depending on the tier. So I'm going to do $2 a player. So let's say I'm going to put 72 players. I'm just kind of trying to go with reasonable numbers here, times two. So that's roughly another 670,000. So, gross receipts PDGA has some in the coffers. I don't know what their operating expenses are, but now that you hear those numbers and you hear what Brinster is advocating that people put into the majors, 200,000, how does that hit you, Charlie? Is this a good direction for things to go?
Well, let me put it this way. Given the fact that the Pro Tour seems capable of running the, well, Elite Series, let's call it, Professional Tour. I mean, I want to say Pro Tour, so I mean, I'm saying the same thing twice. Do we need the PDGA to run the National Tour? Is that necessary? Is that furthering the cause of promoting professional disc golf? I think if you asked me that even 2 years ago, I say, yes, we need it. But I'm not so sure that we're going to need it anymore. And here is the crux of it. If you take the money and the time and the energy that is going into NTs, and instead you put it into the majors, you are going to end up in a spot where maybe you don't even spend that much more money. Let me give you, I just pulled it up, the budgets. Now, I don't have it super broken down, but this is on the PDGA website. You can look up their financial reports. I'm not going through the full 2018 audit right now, but their summary report from 2018 and their projections for 2019. They have not released the new version yet, as far as I know, for 2019-2020. PDGA Tour expenses. Okay, so this is majors and NT event sponsorships, event support, tour insurance, world's invitations and registration, contract support, tour equipment, tour trailer, travel and lodging. All right. 2018, $352,000. 2019 projection, just shy of $450,000. Okay, so now obviously a lot of that money is likely to be the travel, the lodging. But remember, if they take the 5 or 6 NT events off the list and they don't fly all the staff out to those events, you're cutting a lot of costs, which you could then put into the majors, which I think we can all agree are the more important tournaments that deserve more of the fanfare, more of the energy, more of the time, more of the money. So to me, it's about like, where's your trade-off? Now, I'm not saying that we should have the PDGA spending, you know, some significant amount of their annual budget just giving money to pro players at the majors. But I think it is reasonable to say, all right, well, what's the right amount of money that the PDGA can just be like, we're putting this into the pot because we want to establish these majors as really meaningful. And you're probably going to spend far more than the money that you put in as added cash in all of the other things that you do around the majors with the, you know, sending multiple staff members, coordinating all of the volunteer efforts, setting up the courses and all of the work that has to go into that. And that's fine because those are the events that deserve that. Those are the events that we want to make sure are established as the most important. And I think it's weird when there's tournaments that, you know, out purse, I guess, the majors. And that happens a little bit too much right now.
I'm glad you brought up that point, because, you know, if Steve were sitting here, and we hope to have him on soon to talk about this, because I think it's going to be a topic. It's a baby elephant in the room right now. Who should do what going forward? And it's only going to continue to grow, especially if the Pro Tour has a good season. Then that thought is going to grow in people's minds, undoubtedly. So it's interesting, because the one thing we should talk about is, what does that $50,000 go towards? Steve doesn't get specific in that Facebook post from a couple years back, but I think different people, reasonable different people, could have reasonably different interpretations of where that money should be spent. Some people are going to want it to go to the purse. Some people are going to want it to go to the infrastructure of the event. Some people are going to want it to go towards advertising and marketing to bring people to the event or to bring people online. Some people are going to want to put it towards media. There's a lot of different ways you can spend it. But the interesting thing here, Charlie, is I'm glad you found those numbers. Let's just call it $500,000. Let's use easy, you know, bar napkin math here. You've got $500,000 the PDGA is essentially willing to commit to funding a tour. And that was national tour and majors combined, right? The numbers you read to me?
And that was the projection for 2019. That's right.
Okay. So we got about $500,000 they're willing to spend on it. The PDGA is grossing just between tournament player fees and membership fees somewhere in the $3.5 to $4 million range with this basic math. So you're talking about a sixth to an eighth of their annual operating budget on the tour. Now, what's the pro versus amateur makeup of the PDGA? Because I think that's important to consider when we talk about things like this. Well, you have about four times as many amateurs as pros. It's rough. It's, you know, somewhere between 80-20 and 75-25 in favor of AMs. So pros also pay a little bit more for their entry fees, and they pay a little bit more to tournament entry fees. So I think if you're just looking at it at a pure ratio scenario, a quarter of your membership is pro. You're spending a sixth to an eighth of your budget on of your annual grossing budget that we're doing here on those pros. I think it stands to reason by that, and again, that's a very simplistic read on things, but it stands to reason that if you kept that $500,000 and didn't even increase it, just kept it at that same ratio and spent it across four tournaments, if the PDGA drops $125K, whether that's to the purse, whether that's earmarked for media, whatever, I think there's room for a lot of hands in that cookie jar. If you put $125K into four different majors each, I think you would have a significantly greater experience. And you would be able to put on some of the best events in the world, especially if you have really talented people. I mean, think about the best tournament directors in our sport are going to bid if they know that there is a $125,000 grant coming your way if you can prove that you can put on one of the best four events in the world that year. This is exactly what we've been talking about, incentivizing TDs to put on great events. And by the way, let them get paid.
Yes, thank you. They can take a salary for their time, and as Steve pointed out in his posts, they can spend less time trying to wrangle up local sponsors and dealing with all of that. Not that that goes away necessarily, but it really takes the pressure off and allows the TDs to do the thing that they're supposed to do, which is make sure they put on a world-class event. I mean, frankly, it would make sense for the PDGA to hire somebody full-time just to focus on sponsorships. And that person maybe works on getting sponsorships for world championship events and works with the TD. Now, to be clear, that PDGA Tour budget line item that I read, I believe that probably also includes their non-professional majors. So your AM Worlds, your Masters Worlds, your US Masters, USAMs, I mean, all those tournaments that they run. So it's not quite, obviously we're just spitballing here a little bit. We don't have individual data on like how much they spent on NTs. But I think the idea is like if you shifted more of your budget from NTs into majors, establish that system, you're gonna put the, you know, you're gonna put disc golf in a position to have those comparative options. And I think people will say, well, we do have the ability to compare from year to year because we have worlds, or, you know, because we have USDGC. The problem is, in a sport with an individual sport with randomness, you can't look at one event and say that defines their career. I mean, you can if you want, but it feels to me like it's a little weak to just say, well, this person has won, you know, Climo's won the most worlds, so he's the greatest of all time. It's like, well, but shouldn't we look at majors as a whole? The problem is you can't really do that right now because there's not a set number of majors each year.
And because when we've tried to start up new majors, we get the Aussie Open conversation.
We get event where no one shows up.
Oh, it's an asterisk. Oh, it can't be considered because somebody, my favorite pro, couldn't be there. Okay, well then how are you ever going to start majors up?
Well, it's a fair point, but we have to understand, like, if you're just going to have Aussie Open one time and that's what it's called and then it doesn't happen again for another 5 or 10 years, I do think there's an asterisk because it's so fucking far away that nobody can go.
Sure, but you're making my point at the same time. I just broke down in the national tour. I spent some time like making a spreadsheet delineating out all the national tours from its inception up until 2019. There are a ton of events. When you put it on a chronological timeline, there are a ton of events that have been national tours. In fact, I think I can tell you that very quickly here. There have been... I started a spreadsheet. It starts on column B, and it goes to AO. It starts on column E, so minus 5. So 21, 30-something, roughly 40, 35, 40 different events have been a national tour at least once. How many of those have run for multiple years in a row, have garnered that prestige, have become that routine anchor of a tour? Very, very few. Very, very few. I think there are maybe like only 3 or 4 national tour locations that have run more than 10 times. Now, there's been 17 years of the national tour, so that's a significant chunk of it. But just to kind of show you that most of these events come and go. And I think this gets to the heart of what Steve is saying, that it's going to be hard to stand up an entire tour. We watched the World Tour try. We've watched the Pro Tour false start and then eventually become what it is now through a lot of growing pains and trial and error. We saw that American Disc Golf Tour debacle try as well. It's hard to run a tour. So I think the big point of what Steve is making is let's start with the majors. And we have all this data now that backs up his argument. I mean, look at the pros love the majors, as evidenced by the survey we did. Overwhelmingly positive feedback about what the majors mean to touring pros. No touring pro is going to tell you that any other major than Worlds is the highest title in the land with a straight face. And
sure,
it's much, much easier, obviously, if you can standardize it at 4, and it goes back to all the great things Steve said. So rather than false starting, trying to grow these majors in different places and grow these NTs in different places, let's circle the wagons, say, look what we've learned through all these years, and let's give 4 events a quality, well-thought-out, well-funded foundation to go forward into the future. So we're not just comparing it to last year and just saying, oh, well, what did they do compared to then? Like, let's just objectively have a badass event. And by the way, Charlie, you're 100% correct. PDGA, those line items, they're considering all majors, not just the majors we talk about on the show, which is a lot. So that's something to consider. They're not actually spending that much on each individual event. They have to go to a lot of places.
Yeah, and, you know, they also, I mean, I didn't really mention this, but they from their tour events, from sanctioning, insurance fees, for participating and whatnot, their revenue in 2018 was over $1 million. So they're making a lot of money from having fees and, you know, sanctioning events. And so they're spending, you know, less than half of that on turning around and running those events. And, you know, keep in mind that they make over $2 million a year in memberships. Their total income in 2018 was $3.8 million. So, you know, obviously you don't want to just see all that money turn around and go into pros' pockets. The PDGA does a lot of things. And I would argue that they should probably start doing even less for pros in some sense and focusing more on their other initiatives. But, you know, really emphasizing the majors, well, it's such an obvious way to maximize the impact of promoting the top level of the sport, because it's already where people look to. You know, people don't just tune in. You don't have 15,000 people live on YouTube watching a random disc golf pro tour event. You just don't. And that's okay, because people want to tune in and watch Worlds. They want to tune in and watch USDGC. And that's, we need to establish a codified system that goes forward. You know, whether you want to say that it should be three or it should be four, people are going to have disagreements there. But we need to have a plan that makes sense, and we can establish now, because this is really a turning point, isn't it, in the sport right now. You have, you know, more people coming in. You have people making real money as professional disc golfers at this point. And, you know, you have this burgeoning interest in Europe, the insane growth of the European Open, the fans that they get there. This is a chance to really say, all right, from here on out, this is how we're going to do our majors. It's not going to be year to year ad hoc. We'll see what happens. Depends on bids. It's like, no, we're doing four. And this is what they're going to be called. And this is what they're going to be called forever. And some you have it at one location, and other places you rotate. Great. You know, why try to remake the wheel when other sports have already designed the wheel and honed it over many, many years, and have people, you know, have millions and millions of participants worldwide and people making millions of dollars at the highest level?
Do you know why USDGC is so good? This is going to be really important. It's because they have an organization. And let's, for the moment, suspend disbelief, leave the manufacturer side out of it, right? Because obviously that's the thing that they can do. They can create the fundraiser discs to sell. But just ignore that for a moment. They have an organization of people that focus on preparing this event every year. And of course, Innova employees, the whole factory, the whole everybody, they get behind it and they're all out helping and all that stuff, because we're still disc golf. But that group of people operates in the same way that the groups that host the PGA majors operate, in the sense that you have people whose focus is on making that event year after year after year, that it's not an afterthought, that it's not, oh, who's our club president this year for our local club? Okay, cool. Does he or she have friends that are reliable that can help start recruiting volunteers? Oh, what local business owners does that person happen to know? Right? You're trading, in most cases, on the individual relationships of the TD and of that TD social circles. We all know a person in our local scene who's tried to start a league or tried to start like an alternative organization format, and that person, like, they didn't really have the connections, they didn't really have like the backing of the other local players, and their project just kind of fizzled. We all know or know somebody that has that kind of story, right? So what we have to do is we have to take cues. We can't keep allowing the quality of the majors to be in question up until the event starts. When you have great tournament directors, when you have great events like European Open, like USDGC, when Worlds is in the hands of the really, really great TDs, most of the time you see that they have a group around them. They have an organization around them that's supporting them. So the most important thing that could be rethought if we're talking about pursuing this direction that Steve's advocating, and that frankly I'm pretty behind as well, the advantage is that it allows groups to organize and to focus on making this event awesome. And when you have that consistency year over year, when you allow sponsors, the big thing we're all hoping for, right? Outside sponsors. That's our big thing in disc golf. Outside sponsors. They need to have a consistent relationship, and it's much easier to do that if they can have a relationship with a group, with a, call it a company, whatever. If you want to make it an LLC or a nonprofit or whatever the hell you want to do, fine. But they have that organization, that entity that they work with year after year. So even if people come and go, because it's hard work to put on these events, that entity retains the trust of the local community. It retains the trust of the businesses that want to contribute. It maintains a good relationship with the PDGA as the board of directors the people serve come and go, as changes in PDGA staff may happen. It allows you to continue to build more efficiently on what you did before. And until we really start worrying about the quality of the support, or considering more the quality of the support we're putting into each individual event over the quantity of how many events we can support, it's going to be really difficult to do that. And I just think that is really at the core of moving majors to the next level.
I was just looking at USGA's website, the U.S. Golf Association. They run the U.S. Open in golf. Now, obviously, they're a much, much bigger organization than the PDGA. But they have people whose job is just to focus on individual tournaments. So there's a guy named Reg Jones. He serves as the USGA's managing director of open championships. He is accountable for outside the ropes strategy and operations for the four USGA Opens, the U.S. Open, the U.S. Women's Open, the U.S. Senior Open, and the U.S. Senior Women's Open. That's his whole job. That's his whole job, right?
Copy-paste.
That's what I'm saying. Like, the PDGA probably needs somebody whose job is just, literally just to focus on professional majors. And that's their job. Now, I don't know if they can support that position yet. I don't know if it makes sense yet. I'm not inside the organization. And it's not like they don't have events people. Of course they do. But I don't think they have somebody whose job is to focus on the pro majors. And that's what they do. Because let's be honest, it's a very different job than focusing on the AM majors. It just is. Mm-hmm. And so you have somebody who, you know, they're spending significant time getting ready for the 2021 majors right now. They're already thinking about next year. They're working with the TD day in and day out, and that's their entire job. I think we need that. I mean, I think that that position should exist in the same way that, you know, the Pro Tour has a tour director who is doing that job. So just some thoughts. I think there's, you know, there's a lot of things that that can be modernized at this point in disc golf, and we're getting there.
Yeah. I'm really curious to know overall, and I think this is probably a pretty good point to leave this discussion for now and pick it up at another time. But when we do so, I'm curious to know, is the PDGA's burn rate, is their budget aggressive or is it conservative? And obviously the perception of that may differ inside the organization and outside, because if it's conservative, the seed that I would plant in people's minds here is, if there was any time in the history of the sport to roll the dice, and get a little more aggressive? Isn't it now? I mean, what other signs do we need?
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is coronavirus and the impact on memberships, and, you know, they've had to furlough staff. I get what you're saying, though. In general,
on the backs of it, on the back of it,
they were net plus $370,000 in 2018.
Yeah, you hope they have coffers to absorb this
year.
They
surely do.
But that is the big question. On the back of this, if they have the opportunity to be more aggressive on the rebound, you know, like you catch the stock market in a low and you try to ride the balloon up. Does it always work? No, certainly not. But if you really felt like, okay, disc golf could make a jump in people's perception, in if there was a leaderboard of sports, if there was a, you know, breakdown of tiers of how well received or how popular or whatever sports were, if disc golf wants to kind of make a jump on the back of all this, if you're able to, that might be the time. So something to think about.
We're going to shift our conversation from the PDGA over to the Disc Golf Pro Tour and talk about the future of the Disc Golf Pro Tour in our subscriber bonus segment. So we hope you'll join us over there. That will do it for today's show. I won't be here next week, but Jamie will be holding it down and getting you ready for the restart of the DGPT with the Dynamic Discs Open. Jamie, good luck on the broadcast. I will try to tune in. I don't know if I'm going to be able to. I'm going to a lake house that has very, very limited cell, basically zero cell reception and crappy internet. So I'll do my best. So good luck with the broadcast.
Thank you. And get off the grid a little bit, because you know when you get back, you can always watch it on Disc Golf Network after the fact.
You are right. Plug. You are right. All right. So that's going to do it for today's show. He's Jamie Thomas. I'm Charlie Eisenhood, saying so long. And Jamie will talk to you next week right here on The Upshot.
We'll see you.